Welcome to Orphans No More, a media extension of Justice for Orphans, a ministry dedicated to rally the church for the cause of the fatherless, inspiring, educating, and equipping believers to care for vulnerable children, and supporting those who have heard and heeded the call of James 1:27. Here's your host, Sandra Flack.
Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, submit to Him, and He will make your path straight. That is Proverbs 3, verses 5 and 6. I'm your host, Sandra Flack. Thank you for joining us today for episode 243 of the Orphans No More podcast. If you think my voice sounds a little odd, if you're a regular listener, you may notice that, and I have a little bit of a cold, just the old-fashioned common cold that actually still does exist in the world. I do not have COVID, and I'm actually feeling pretty good. I just have a little bit of a nasally sound. So just to let you know that. And before we officially get started, I want to tell you about an amazing video that we produced featuring the work of our nonprofit, Justice for Orphans, and the local impact we're having through our Care Portal platform. If you don't know about Care Portal, that is an online technology platform. We connect local child welfare agencies with local churches so that the church is aware of needs of local families who are in crisis, children who are in danger of being removed from their homes and placed in foster care, not because of abuse, but more often because of what looks like neglect or just the families lacking some serious supports. And the church can actually step in, wrap around that family, stabilize a biological family, and keep kids home. Sometimes when kids are removed from home, then caseworkers can enter requests to help foster families, help adoptive families, help kinship families where there's a relative taking care of a child. So it's all about caring for children in crisis. So it's a 5-minute video that we just produced. It's on our website. It's so inspiring, and I'm hoping that you'll check it out. You can find it on our website at justicefororphansny.org. Just click on Care Portal, and it's the very first video at the top of that page. You can also find the video on our YouTube channel. We have a Justice for Orphans YouTube channel now, so you can go there. If you go to our website and go to our Care Portal tab, as long as you're there and you watch that video, and you can scroll to the bottom of that page, and then you can actually catch a really cool 8-minute video produced by a well-known sports channel. And that video features Care Portal and our partnership with Liberty University's football team and how that's impacted child welfare across the country. So that's really amazing. So I hope you'll check that out. And if you do, let me know. I'd love to hear your feedback. We love hearing from you, our listeners. We pray for you on a regular basis. So we'd love to hear from you. You can contact us by our website, also on social media at Justice for Orphans. And you can also email me directly. And my email address is sandraflack@gmail.com. So this week, I'm talking with fellow New York adoptive mom, Laura Poussant, is from from where I am in upstate New York in the Capital Region. She is way western New York near Buffalo. She and her husband, Steve, adopted 5 children all through the foster care system. Laura knows about parenting kids with trauma, kids with FASD. Their family is biracial, so they're familiar with racial tensions, and she's been navigating it all through this crazy COVID season we are all in. We're going to talk about all of it today as we unpack their story. So I'm so excited. Please welcome Laura Poussant. Hey, Laura.
Hi, I'm so excited to be here.
I'm so excited to have you here. Yeah, we finally decided to just press the record button because we've been having all these great conversations before we even started the podcast today. So we thought we'd let our listeners in on it. So Here we are. So I'm so excited, and I want to just kind of start at the beginning and have you roll out your story for us and how you got on this journey. You and Steve started fostering 18 years ago. I know you've got a lot of amazing stuff to tell us. What led you guys to take that plunge and begin fostering?
Wow. Well, I know it's, you say 18 years, it seems like just yesterday, right? So we actually met through work, and he was my boss, believe it or not, in a restaurant. So, but we were friends, and we ended up, you know, obviously took that the next step, got married, and you know, during dating in our first year or so of marriage, you talk about kids and family. And we wanted to have a boy and a girl. That was what it looked like. And over a few years, we realized I had endometriosis and had some surgeries. And it, you know, every surgery, it got harder to like handle it, I would say. A lot of my friends and my sisters, everybody is starting to get pregnant and have baby showers. And you're just kind of dealing with this loss a little bit at a time. We tried infertility treatments and it took a toll. It took a toll on us emotionally, physically, trying to fake the smile as you go along. And so I was in a really bad place, really bad place. I just didn't want to leave the house. I was real depressed. And at the time, my husband worked in the restaurant still. And there was a couple that would come in every so often, and he'd talk about them, and they were regulars. And he said, you know, they're foster parents. And I'm like, yeah, okay, great. You know, like, whatever. You know, I didn't really even think about it. At that point, I never knew anybody who was a foster parent. It was very new to me. So one night he had called me and said, you need to come in and meet this couple. They have this little baby. And I thought, no, I'm not doing that. I'm comfortable. It's snowing out. And you're about 40 minutes away. He's like, trust me. And everything in my whole being really didn't want to, but I felt a tug. And at the time, you know, I knew God, but I didn't have a close relationship. And so I thought, okay, well, I'll go, but I don't know what the point is. So I drove out there, and the whole time I'm thinking, great, so I can see this baby. And then, you know, all these negative thoughts. And I got out there, and this couple, they looked almost like what you would picture, like Santa Claus and Mrs. Claus. Like, just, she had rosy cheeks and this like beautiful white hair, and just like everything about this couple, you were like, I just love them. And then I looked down and she was holding this baby, and I locked eyes and I thought, I fell in love from the second I saw this little one. She was wearing pink and she had a little bow, and I sat down and I had never met them. And I'm like, hi, can I hold? Like, I was just like drawn. And so I started talking to them. The baby, I remember just her clinging on to me and looking up at me. And I just, nothing else mattered at that time. And we were talking and just talking. And I left. It was, the restaurant was closing. I mean, it was hours later. And my husband was walking me out to the car. And he's like, so weren't they great? And I looked at him. I said, she's our daughter. And he's like, oh, okay. I'm like, no, I'm serious. I'm telling you, she's our daughter. And I don't know at the time if I really knew what that meant, but I just had this feeling. So as I was driving home, I couldn't process anything. I just thought about it and stuff. So one thing led to another, and we got to talking to them more and more, and they were in Erie County. And at the time we were in Niagara County. So we reached out and started to look into what does it look like to be foster parents and adoptive parents. I went in wanting to be an adoptive parent. I'm like, I see a baby. I want to adopt her. Check the box. Yeah. My husband was like, oh, let's foster. I'm like, I can't have children. Why would I give children back? Like, I'm not doing, like, I was set. I was not doing it, you know. We started to do the courses, and it opened up a world I had never known about. My heart was open more. We just, everything about it was just amazing. Well, during that time, I was visiting this couple. I worked out that way. So I'd call, and we built such a great relationship. So I'd see this little girl on the weekends, and we'd visit and stuff. And fast forward, she's our oldest 17-year-old daughter.
Wow.
When I think about, I'm going to get all choked up. When I think about it, it's pretty amazing because when we first started, I had to go through the grief of not being able to biologically have children. I think if you don't go through that, you can definitely go down a path of just more heartbreak. And, you know, did it still bother me here and there that I'd go to baby shower and stuff? Yeah, but it wasn't the same. It was like, you know what, it's not going to look that way for me. I was grieving the loss of what it would feel like, what it would look like, what should it look like, what was it supposed to be. You know, we were getting married and I was going to get pregnant. We were going to have to shower and have a baby and, you know, everything happily ever after. It looked nothing like that. And yet, as we were going along, I'm just falling more in love with this little one, more in love. And because of, unfortunately, the way our system is right now and has been, it is not, I would say it's broken. There's a lot of things that need to be fixed and changed. And we met plenty of blocks along the way when trying to adopt her. We were told by someone that, you know, we are a white couple and she's mixed. She looks African-American, you know, she definitely just was the cutest and still is the cutest. And we were told, yeah, no, that's not going to work. And I thought, what do you mean? I love her. We love her. Like, no, that's not okay. It was the first time I was really faced something like that. And I was young. I was in my early 20s. So I was, if I was the person I was now, I'm sure I would have been more vocal. But at the time, I didn't really say a whole lot. And I thought, oh my goodness. And then we were met with, you know, there were siblings that were found and possible adoption with the siblings, but we didn't know the siblings and they were that much older and there was a lot of trauma there. It was like a roller coaster. And the emotional part, I thought, was going to break us. I really did. I didn't understand it, didn't know it. However, we just kept moving on. During that time, we got certified, obviously, to foster, and we didn't know what that would look like. I'm trying to think. It was, I don't even remember the month at this point, but that's during that time we were getting my daughter on the weekends visiting, and we got a call saying, there's a child that has been brought to the police station, and we're going to bring her over, and, you know, she's coming to your house. And I thought, oh my goodness, we're getting our first foster child. This is exciting. I don't know what to do. Actually, I say first, prior to that, we did get a placement of a boy and a girl, emergency placement in the middle of a snowstorm. And it was like 24 hours, and it rocked me because here I'm like, not a mom. Then here's two kids. And I don't know what to do at this point. We had things and we had training, but I'm like, ah, and then they left. And you know, we were there for that period of time for them and they were so sweet and wonderful. And they just really needed a safe place to stay for that evening. So then Maya, I guess technically that would be the third, right? So, I remember coming home and Steve was already there and I was so nervous and I walked into the living room and I looked down and I saw this little baby who was 7 months old, full head of curls, just full head of curls, big smile, and very malnourished and dirty. At the time, I didn't connect it. Obviously, now I realize the two don't really go together. Mm-hmm. A child who is filthy and malnourished but is smiling. So looking back, I know trauma, obviously there was trauma there, big time. Yeah. So I just, oh my goodness, we were just in love with this little one. And it broke our hearts to see the condition she was in because, you know, there was a lot behind that. And And it's sad. That's the hard part of all of it is that things you see, you can't unsee. The things you hear, you can't unhear. But I know that we were put there on purpose and we were going to do whatever we had to do. And so fast forward, that's our second 17-year-old daughter, Maya. It took us 4 years to adopt her. It was not easy. We actually, you know, going into it, when you're doing foster care, the goal is to return to parents. And it's hard when maybe you don't necessarily agree with what that looks like, because you love the kids. If you don't love them, you're not doing it right. You make a connection. And so what was happening was Maya was at our house and McKenna was there and they created this special bond. So 2 times Maya almost went back home and I thought, oh my goodness, what's going to happen? And it was weird because I kind of in my heart knew, I don't think this is going to happen. And it's not that I wanted her birth mom to fail. I really, truly didn't. I think it was just us trying to do what was best for Maya. So we ended up adopting her. And, you know, I had the 2 girls. And I was like, okay, that's where we're at. We're good. Like, okay.
Yeah. So the first baby that you saw in the restaurant,
mm-hmm.
You were able to adopt her, and that's mm-hmm. McKenna, right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And then through that whole process, you started fostering and you got Maya.
Maya, mm-hmm. Who is 3 months younger. So they're both 17.
Wow. So they're just 3 months apart. So it's like basically raising twins at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're not biologically related. So you have McKenna and you have Maya.
Right.
And you continued to foster.
We did. We had several placements throughout. So over this whole span, we've had 14 placements and then our 5 adopted children. So, you know, with each placement, I really took it as what can we do for this child while they're in our home? And if they stay, that's amazing. And if they don't, that's okay too. But does it make it easy? No, it's heartbreaking, especially when they go back in a situation where you don't feel is correct. But then I kind of take a look back and go, well, what does that mean? Correct. In my eyes, or, you know, I think our own idea of, well, my house is the best house. I want them to stay here. This is, you know, where they're loved and taken care of. But I also had to release some of that because it will make you go down a kind of just an unhealthy emotional place. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I wasn't always good at that, but you try, you know. So then, yeah, I had the 2 girls, and about a year later, the phone rang. And every time the phone rang and I saw it was a case where I was like, oh, you know, what is this? What does this mean? And they said, McKenna's birth mom had a baby. And I'm like, okay, another girl. Because we were in Niagara County, the same couple that had McKenna got her just until they were able to put her into our home. So it was in a matter of a few days, I think, just because the county thing. And that's our daughter, Michaela. So she's our 15-year-old. And every time they were born, their birth mom never stayed in the hospital. You know, we knew that there were drugs and no prenatal care for 9 months. She had a friend on the paperwork that's, you know, what it says, but who knows what that looks like. And so smoking and, you know, drinking and whatnot. But at the time, you look at the drugs because that's what we knew. It was like, oh, they're born addicted. What does that look like? And they were, you know, doing great at this point. We were outgrowing our house pretty quick. During that time, we lived in a place, it was our first home, and our 3 girls, you know, biracial, I would take them for walks. And that's when we started to get comments. just yelled out a couple of times. And I thought, oh goodness, that words that I'm like, are you racial slurs, shocked me.
Wow.
Shocked me.
Yeah.
Questions people would ask. You know, you get used to the questions like, where'd you get them from? You know, or are they all yours? How did you know? And sometimes you know when people are asking, but sometimes you want to go, well, I got them from a catalog. Like, what do you, you know, because you get so mad because you're like, they're children. And you want to be able to share some of it, but some of it's personal too. And you also go, it's their story. I don't want to have to throw everything out on the table either sometimes. So I remember telling my husband, we're moving. We have to move. I'm not okay. I don't want to raise him in an area that's not going to be open to diversity. I don't know where we're going, but we're moving. So this was a year after we got Michaela, and we had just gotten off the phone with the realtor, I think. And the for sale sign was coming up, and the county called. And I thought, okay, I don't know why they're calling. Like, what's good, you know? And they said, McKenna and Michaela's birth mom had a baby. And I just remember standing there going, uh-huh. Okay. She's like, it's a boy. And I'm like, I have to call my husband at work. But in my mind, it was like, well, absolutely, we'll take, like, there's not a question. And in the meantime, you know, you're sleep deprived. And our other daughter, Maya, was going on her visits back and forth. And that was traumatic in itself. And so we had all this stuff going on. But it was almost like when you're in it, you do it.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I didn't think twice. I'm like, okay, this is just typical, normal. And of course, we had a puppy in the mix of all of it. And so there was a lot going on. And I called my husband at work and I said, guess what? And he's like, are you crazy? And I'm like, no, we're getting him. And he's like, Laura, I know your heart, but at some point I'm like, oh, well, you don't have to agree, but we're getting him. Like, I was just a question. And the phone call didn't end well at first, you know. We both sat for a little bit, prayed on it, called him back. He's like, okay, when are you picking him up? And I was like, okay, I know, you know. So at that point, my husband was in a different job, and it was a business job where he worked a lot of hours, and it was high stress, so he couldn't get a lot of days off and things like that. So I called my mom. I said, can you go to the hospital and get him with me? And they said, he's a preemie, he's little. And when they say that, when you see it, it's very different. And when I went to the hospital, I was like, oh my goodness. His head was probably the size of an orange. He was little. He was like, wow. 4 pounds. And I remember thinking a couple of things. I remember thinking, this is the brother, half brother. We didn't really know dads at this point. But I'm like, he's Caucasian, but he's the brother. Wait a minute. So now I was kind of taken back a little bit. Not that it mattered to us at all, but in your mind, you have this picture of what it's going to look like. And then you go there and you're like, wait a minute. And I remember bringing him into my husband's work. And because I was so excited, I was like, we're going home, and I'm bringing him in. And he's like, oh. And I think he thought, you know, at first we're like, wait a minute. But now we know that their birth mom had lighter skin. So we're assuming, because a lot of times you don't have the pieces, different dads, you know. And I remember bringing him home, and my girls just loved him. They thought he was a baby doll. They were so sweet with him, and he was a good baby. He slept. I mean, he really, just was very quiet, and that has not changed. His name is Lucas, and he is our 14-year-old, and, just looking back, all these things start popping up of things that you would see. But at the time, like I said, you know, I had nothing to compare it to. I compared it to my childhood and growing up. And that's just what you did. You parent how you knew, kind of. In the meantime, obviously, we were busy looking for a house. And we found a home in an area that it was an area we knew we probably couldn't afford, but because the home needed work and had some issues, I didn't care. I was like, we're good. And when we came into the driveway, the neighbor at the time came out and she said, you know, that house has some issues and stuff. And I said, yeah. And she goes, what's in the car? She's, oh my goodness, look at all those little ones. And we had Lucas and then three girls. And I remember each time I'm like, do we need to get a new car? You know, we slowly go from like a Jeep Cherokee, then we got a minivan, you know, slowly go up. And we ended up getting that house. And even though the house had issues and had challenges, I mean, it was definitely not great foundation. But we wanted to be in an area where we felt like there was acceptance more so. The neighborhood was amazing. They were like family. I mean, we just fell in love with them and they loved watching our kids outside and playing, and it was great. As that year went by, we got another call and it was county again. Mommy had another baby, and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, like what's the number, right? At this point,
how many times are we going to do this? Yeah. Right.
Yeah. We were so new and I was like, what's the number? How is this going to work? And they said, you know, it was different this time because the last few times mom left the hospital, there was no connection. We had one picture of her that she was on the news one day and the caseworker called, and it wasn't for good reasons. And she said, you know, just to let you know. And I thought, well, we'll keep it for the files. Okay. And we pray for her all the time because my heart really breaks for her, knowing that she's probably so broken herself. And, you know, I never got to a point where I'm not going to understand what she's done, but I really feel for her. There's that part where I feel for her that she's had to miss out on all of this. And I don't know. I didn't know where her mindset was at this point. So when they called us, they said she had another boy. He is going through some challenges in the hospital. And we just, the nurses were amazing at the hospital and they for us. And so I got nervous because I thought, what if I see her? What am I going to say? So we went to the hospital and Aiden, well, there was a baby there. We went in and he was in the NICU for about a week. And just the sweetest little boy. And I remember he had this red birthmark and over his eyebrow. And at the time I was like, you know what? That's where God kissed him. Like he was just like, it was just so sweet. And we brought him home. It was a good sized baby. He was like roly-poly, just rolls everywhere. And that's our youngest now, Aiden, and he is 13.
Wow.
So at that point, we had, let me say, five under five. I would take them on walks, and people would say, what preschool is this? I'm like, no. Yeah, it's our kids, you know. We definitely learned how to multitask, for sure. But it's funny because even though it was obviously a lot, they were each other's playmates. Like, they really just got along really well. And it was almost like it made sense. It clicked. I thought at that point we're good. We're doing all right. And then they got a call. We got a call. We were still fostering at this point, but obviously we weren't taking in placements necessarily. We got a call and they said it's our daughter Maya's brother, half brother, and he was 3 months younger than Aiden. So I was like, okay. So he came to our house. He was not with us very long. He did end up going with a family member. And that was hard because I thought our one daughter who's not blood related to the four, is she going to ever feel that, you know? But because they were that much younger, we never knew what the effects would be later on. And to this day, I think, you know, it's funny that there's another connection there, which I'll get into. So we had we had the five and we were busy and it was fun and crazy and hard. Yep.
Yeah, no, I love that. You've got all five, all came through foster care. Mm-hmm. And their ages, just so our listeners can keep up. So they were five, you had five kids, basically five and under.
Yeah.
But fast forward to today, and now they're, and correct me if I'm wrong, 17, mm-hmm. 17,
yep.
15, mm-hmm. 14?
Yep. And 13.
And 13. Wow. Yeah. Wow.
In a pandemic. Sure. In a pandemic.
And not only that, so you've got teenagers. I mean, teenagers in general are scary. You've got five teenagers.
Yeah. But
let's talk fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, yeah. because that is part of your story. Mm-hmm. Part of my family's story as well. And just for our listeners, FASD, nearly, it's like 75 maybe percent of children in the foster care system mm-hmm. have been exposed to alcohol in the womb. And I did a little bit of math because, you know, the statistics say there's almost 400,000 children in foster care. And if you go with like 75%, 300,000 kids, and that's just the kids in foster care, right? Yeah. So, you know, this is prevalent. Mm-hmm. It's not really taught in the foster parent training classes. It should be. So tell us about what's your experience been like with your kids and FASD?
Sure. Well, it's interesting because when they were younger, there wasn't, I never heard of FASD. And if I did, it was like, you looked a certain way if you had fetal alcohol. Like that was just what we knew and you moved on. There was no such thing that I knew. And no one talked about the alcohol piece. It was always about the drugs because all the kids were exposed in utero. It was about that type of thing and what your image of what that looks like. Once they started school, there were things that would come up here and there. My oldest daughter was beyond shy, almost painfully shy. And her kindergarten teacher said, "Does she talk?" I don't think she said a word the whole school year. And it's funny because my other daughter, the same age, talks all the time. So they kind of, I mean, when they were opposites. And so I just thought, well, maybe it's her personality because you're trying to fill in the blanks too. You don't have all the genetic pieces when you adopt. So you're like, maybe it's just how it is. We had testing done, early intervention, and everything seemed okay. And as we were going through school, you know, little pieces of things would start coming up, but nothing that was like a red flag at this point. At least we didn't think. And so then when Lucas, he's not following everything. He's looking at other people's pages and whatnot. And so I thought, okay, she goes, "I think you should get his hearing tested. Maybe, I don't know, I could be wrong, but check out auditory processing." I thought, I have no idea what you're talking about, but okay. Prior to this, Lucas did have a lot of STEM behaviors. And I just thought it was part of him at first. You don't know what you don't know, right? And right. So he would hum a lot to himself or rock a little or, you know, kind of like do something on his face till there was a rash. And, you know, we brought it up with the pediatrician and stuff and he went and got tested for autism. And they're like, no, I mean, we did a gamut of it. They came back and said, yes, it's auditory processing. He can't block out the noises behind what he's hearing. So background noises. So there's something called FM box that would help them through school. So they were going to put an FM box either on the desk or like around, the teacher would have a necklace with a microphone and the FM box would go kind of right to him. So it would help him. So, so with Lucas, you know, that was the beginning of our journey with IEP meetings and figuring out what an IEP is, what does that mean? What services does he need? And my sister, both my sisters are educators, so they helped me through that process. And we thought, okay, well, he just needs extra help. What we did realize is anytime we would go out somewhere, loud noises, crowds, he would melt down. And when I say melt down, it was crying, almost like he couldn't control himself. And I always thought it was low blood sugar. I'm like, oh, he needs to eat. He needs to eat, you know. Didn't think too much about it, just he needs to eat. Now, looking back, I know it was sensory overload. Mm. And it was a lot. And of course, you know, when your kids are younger, you go to amusement park, you go here and there, and we have the kids and it's supposed to be fun and great. And why is he melting down every time we do this? Then I noticed he would do things with his little cars. He was obsessed with cars, and he would line them up by color and for hours would just play with them. And certain things I thought, well, maybe that's just how he is, but it was overly almost done where he was, it was a calming thing for him, but if he got upset, he would go and do that. Or if we had company over, I'd look around and he'd be up in his room, never liked the crowds, the loud noises. Right. So, yeah. So then Aiden started school, and Aiden really struggled in kindergarten, and he ended up repeating kindergarten. His teacher was the same one Lucas had, and she was great. But she's like, things aren't sticking. You know, it's almost like there's no, nothing is really staying with what he's learning, but some days it was. So still at this point, I had no idea. You know, you go where they tell you to go. You go to the pediatrician, you go to the doctors and whatnot. And then my girls were starting middle school. And middle school is its own beast, I would say. Yeah. And that, you know, you start the whole hormone piece. And that's when things really became more apparent. At the time, and I'm doing dates in my mind here. I remember thinking my daughter, my oldest, the processing alone, when you'd ask her a question, it would take her a long time to respond. And at first I'm like, did you hear me? Yeah, I heard you. But I wasn't getting the response right away. And then I realized, like, she's really processing what we're saying. So there were those pieces. So I asked at the time for her to get checked for an IEP. And they tested her, and she did fine, didn't need anything. But yet, I didn't feel okay about it. But once again, she was our oldest. We never did this before. I didn't know anything about, you know, services and things like that. So you're like, well, I'm trusting the fact that this is what the school says, and okay. And then as middle school went on, I was seeing certain things that were sticking out here and there of just social interactions with peers. It was very uncomfortable for me to see some of it because it wasn't a natural thing. It was, I want to be with my friends. I remember she had a birthday party and all of her friends were dancing and it was her party. And she was in the corner with headphones on listening to music. Mm. I thought, oh, but of course at the time I'm like, stop being rude. Go play with your, you know, because you don't know. And I remember, you know, things like that would start coming up. And she would look at me and just, I felt bad because I'm like, why don't you want to hang out with your friends? What's going on? And then when she was, it was like that social, it didn't match up. It was a lot younger. So I just thought this is her personality and love everything about her. And I thought, you know what? She's very artistic and she's very good at reading and stuff. This is, you know, her personality. It wasn't until high school with her that we really noticed more and more that I'm just not getting a good feeling about certain things. You know, assignments would come, and if she missed one, all of a sudden there were 10 missing, and she would look and go, I don't know how to make this better and change it. There was a lot of more than one step things were challenging. memory piece, you know, I'd ask something and then it was like, well, by the time you get downstairs, why am I down here? So there were a lot of those things. So that's when I said, you know, and mind you, prior to this with her, we had the other ones going through the schools too. So I was learning more with my husband as we went along. We ended up finding an amazing woman who was a retired psychologist for a school district who specialized in neurodevelopment. And it was through a friend. And she said, I will do the testing for your daughter on my own over the summer. Let's see what we can come up with. So I brought McKenna there a couple of times and she did all the tests and realized, oh my goodness, she can spell words that I can't even say. But if I give her a grocery list and have her repeat it back, she can't. And I thought, okay, all right. So that's when we knew at that point, you know, definitely to, you know, get testing done. But she was actually the third one we got tested. We ended up getting, I'm trying to keep it in order here for you. So we ended up, what all started all of it was a group called Relational Parenting through our church. We're part of a ministry called the Every Child Ministry, who my husband is the executive director for, and it's a foster adoption ministry, which is amazing how God works, because here he was in restaurants and then business and whatnot. And we were sitting in church one day and they were talking about starting an adoption, you know, foster care ministry. And I remember hitting him going, that's us. This is us. And he's like, oh, okay. So he volunteered for a while and then it was a part-time job and now it's a full-time job and it's come full circle. And I mean, it's been amazing. So part of that program, there's wraparound services and there's a bunch of things that they do. And one of them is the Relational Parenting Group. And it's people that have fostered and or adopt or are in it, or, you know, are past the courts and at all different levels. And I became really good friends with a lot of these people. You'd see them, you know, once a month we'd meet and it was a safe place for us to just feel like we weren't being judged. We were talking about stuff that was like going on and we couldn't understand it. And I remember these two amazing women talked about going to this place in Rochester, which is about an hour from us. And they got their adoptive kids tested for fetal alcohol and they started talking and I was listening and all of a sudden it was that, oh, yep, yeah, that sounds very familiar. Tell me more about this. I want to know more. So I got talking to them. I said, who do I need to call? So I remember coming home and tell my husband and he's like, no. And I'm like, no, we have to make an appointment. And I'm sure you know, anything along that line, there is a good waiting list and it's definitely a process. So I knew we were in it, you know, we're going to get this done. So we set it up for our youngest to start. Because with our youngest Aiden, he was having more outwardly challenges, noticeable, I should say, right? So mm-hmm. Things we would notice more. He's a sensory seeker. I mean, he wants to be next to you 24/7. And he's tall. He's a big guy. And it's just more noticeable, I would say. And we took him to Rochester and I remember it was the first time that I felt that people were hearing us. Mm. I felt like they saw us. I wanted to cry. I mean, even the receptionists were so nice because at this point we had gone through so much testing because in my gut, I knew there's more, something's not right. It's off. And then when we'd be around people, they'd say, I don't know what you're talking about. And I'm like, I'm telling you it's, and then, you know, of course you take it as, is it me? Is it my parenting? What's going on? But I'm like, no, there's these things that just nothing's adding up. And having the door shut many times. We went to a really known, neurodevelopment place in our area and a pediatric doctor right in front of him was, you know, saying, no, he doesn't have the features. And I remember leaving there so angry because I thought it takes 3 days out of the full 9 months for them to get features. But they don't need to have features to have fetal alcohol spectrum, and there's brain damage. But I thought, you're in this business. Like, I was just floored that nobody in our area could help us. And so, like I said, when we went to Rochester, it was like nicest people. Their waiting room was amazing. They had a sensory room. I just felt like we were home for the first time, like, here we are. And I can't tell you enough. They were amazing. So we ended up, he went in one room and worked with someone, and they were great. I was nervous, you know, if he was going to be nervous. And we were in another room, and, you know, we filled out a ton of paperwork, questions, whatnot. We ended up meeting and at the end, and they, you know, gave us a diagnosis at the time. And when they give the diagnosis, it's not just one, right? So there's a lot of times it's followed by different things. And so for Aiden, he did not have the features. However, because we knew of DWIs that birth mom had, they assumed, I mean, it's more than likely she didn't have, you know, prenatal care for 9 months. She smoked, she did cocaine and opiates. They're like, yeah, it's probably, you know, part of it. So he was diagnosed with ARND, which is alcohol-related neurodevelopment disorder. And along that, it was general anxiety disorder, executive function deficit, and memory impairment, the verbal. And I think with Aiden, it was outwardly noticeable because of the memory piece. Mm-hmm. I mean, memory is one of those things where we would play the game memory and flip over a card. And I'd say, okay, it's your turn. And he'd flip over the same first card every time. Yeah. And I'm like, you know, and so it's things like that. It's also memory on, do you remember last Christmas this happened or this? And it's like, it's something very new. Yet once in a while, there's things that pop up and you're like, wow, how did you, you know? So at this point, I'm like, I don't understand. I got to figure this brain thing out. What is this? So I remember driving home after getting this diagnosis, and I already in my heart of hearts knew just from talking to these women from the group. I'm like, it is. I don't know if my husband really at that point knew, or as much as how I was feeling, maybe. And we're driving home, and he was quiet, and my son's in the back playing his game, and my husband was just quiet. And I thought, okay, you know, I said, are you okay? Yeah. And I remember looking out the window, and I just, tears were rolling down my face, because it was the first time where I felt like it was bittersweet. We finally had answers.
Yeah.
But the answers we got, there's no fix. There are things that will make it, you know, so that you can get skills and different services and whatnot. But it kind of opens your mind to what does it look like down the road. Yeah. And I just remember looking out the window, and I opened my phone and I said, buddy, we didn't read our, you know, Bible verse yet. And we'd always read like a daily devotional. And I remember at the time it said something about that God has you and follow the light. And I have it written down somewhere, but it was that moment of it's going to be okay. And I really felt more peace than I had felt in a long time. It wasn't until about 2 days after where my husband really, he wasn't seeming himself. And I thought, okay, so finally I brought him to our room. I said, what's going on? What's up? And he just burst into tears. And I think it was that time where it was like, whoa, this is going to look different. And that's okay. But there is a mourning piece. There is a sadness because you adore and love your kids and you don't want them to struggle, especially knowing it could have been prevented. And there's that piece of mourning, there's a piece of anger, there's a piece of, you get scared. I mean, we were feeling all of that. So for the first time when my husband did that, I felt good about it because I thought, okay, we're going to be okay. I don't know what it's going to look like going forward, but it's going to be okay. And during that time, so
I just wanted to jump in for,
sure.
For our listeners who are foster and adoptive parents, mm-hmm. I would like to provide some information to get to the direction to get your child evaluated, some resources to help navigate this road, mm-hmm. Because it is a struggle and it doesn't always, the path doesn't always seem clear. Like right. you said, Laura, you know, there was a time where doctors would just look for the facial features. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not all children, most children who have FASD who are on that spectrum don't have the facial features. Right. They can appear and look very normal, but yet there's these behavioral things.
Yeah.
So you really learned a lot by being in the relational parenting group, mm-hmm. So the support groups, but being with other foster and adoptive parents who are on the same journey is, you know, we learn so much from each other. And as a parent with two diagnosed with FAS, a couple who are probably undiagnosed and you're parenting your kids, we know that there is some great information out there, and we're always students, right? Like you and I are both learning as you go. Every stage, every season is a little bit different. And I've been, you know, I know we've both been listening to the, and we had Jeff Noble on this show not too long ago. And I've been listening to the, FASD Success Podcast, which is amazing. And I recommend that to any foster and adoptive parent, especially if you even mildly suspect there may be FASD. And he had, I learned a new term, and we were just talking about this earlier. I believe it's, I'm always afraid I'm not going to say it right, but it's perseverance, right? And because it is very common in kids.
Perseveration.
Mm-hmm. Perseveration. Yep. Very common in kids with FASD, and it's where they sort of get obsessed and hooked on one thing, mm-hmm. or one word or one thought or one activity. And it's like, I always thought it was like obsessive compulsive disorder or something. It was like they couldn't get off of this. And both of my boys do that, and a little bit different on how they do it, but they do it. And I learned that word and I'm like, oh, write that down. That's like, so there's a name for that, you know, and just knowing there was a name for it. But I came home because I was driving when I heard that. I was listening to that podcast while I was driving. I came home and I Google searched perseveration and FASD, and I found a website. It's Families Affected by Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder, which is FASD.org. And on their website, they have 50 facts. So I'm not going to go over all 50. Maybe eventually we'll get to them down the road in some other shows, but there was just a few things. So for our listeners who maybe, you know, aren't really sure, or they don't really know a whole lot about FASD, or, you know, cause for us, you know, all of four of our children are adopted from Eastern Europe. So I researched it a teeny tiny bit before we adopted, because it's common in kids with adopted from Eastern Europe. And it turns out in the paperwork, the court documents for our children who were, when they were placed in the orphanage, parents were alcoholics. It stated that. So we knew there had to be alcohol exposure. But then I had learned not too long ago from Natalie Vecchione and her podcast, and she's FASD Hope. It's like 70-80% of kids in the foster care system have been exposed to alcohol in the womb. So this is huge. And I think Jeff Noble in his podcast has mentioned that in Canada, because he's Canada based, 3% of the population of Canada has been exposed to alcohol in the womb. So, you know, it could be a cultural thing. It could be, you know, a lot of different things. But so to understand this, it's vital. So I just want to mention to our listeners just a few facts from the FASD website. And fact number one is, you know, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. FASD is not a diagnosis, but an umbrella term that includes a variety of medical diagnoses, including FAS, fetal alcohol syndrome, PFAS, partial fetal alcohol syndrome. And then you mentioned alcohol-related neurodevelopment disorder, and a whole bunch of other things, right? So it's a lot of neurobehavioral stuff. So that's the category where it's the brain, right? The brain gets damaged. Yep. In utero. Fact number two, a little bit more of those statistics, 2 to 5% of babies born in the United States. So all babies, not just foster care babies, but 2 to 5% of all babies born in the United States have FASD. Mm-hmm. That means 2 to 5% of the people in the United States, children and adults, have a FASD. In other words, between one in every 50 and one in every 20 are living with FASD. So, and I shared earlier the stats when it comes to kids in foster care, right? So you've got 70% of them. So that's crazy. And then another one, I found fact number three, even though the number of people with FASD is that high, one in 50 and one in 20, only one in 1,000 are diagnosed. That means 99% of people with FASD are not diagnosed correctly, because sometimes it looks like other things, right? It looks like ADD or ADHD. It can look like all of us in the foster, not all of us, but most of us in the foster and adoption community are familiar with trauma, or sooner or later we get familiar with trauma, right? So I know it was our youngest adopted son who actually has the most significant FASD. It was his behavior after we adopted him, he was five, that we began to look for help, because we knew we were outschooled in parenting him. Like, we were not equipped. And then, so we learned about trauma. We learned about, the connected child, right? And Dr. Purvis and all her work with TBRI. And we attended the Empowered to Connect conferences. We became parent trainers. So trauma is a huge part of this. And sometimes could sort of just pile these behaviors into the trauma category, which FAS is trauma that happens in utero. So it is a trauma, but a lot of what we're seeing, if your kid has FASD, these behaviors are not just because they experienced loss or abuse in other ways, but FAS, being exposed to alcohol in the womb, is a trauma, is a form of abuse. But it's so vastly underdiagnosed, and we need to know about that. Fact number four, and I'm only going to do five, but fact number four, alcohol exposure in utero impacts the brain on a structural, functional, and cellular level. Mm-hmm. Behavioral differences are often the only symptoms. FASD is an invisible physical disability. The brain is part of the body. Isn't it?
Yeah.
So, and again, it's invisible. Kids can look very normal. It's just until you start to interact with them and experience their behaviors, because a couple of my kids have some of those features, but they're not really blatant. Some of them have those features, but some of them don't. And you can't always go by that. And then for the primary statistics, and primary characteristics, and this is FASD fact number five from the FAFASD.org website. Primary characteristics include memory. Now, we've been talking about a lot about that, Laura. Yeah. Processing and executive functioning differences, liability and mood, increased in fight or flight, difficulty with abstraction, developmental dismaturity, appearing younger than they actually are, sensory differences. Okay, so we're all very familiar with that. You were talking about that earlier. Secondary characteristics include aggression, depression, anxiety, isolation. And then tertiary would be things like homelessness. This is down the road, right? As our kids grow up and become adults, and they're not able to really function if they don't get the supports early on. Homelessness, incarceration, substance abuse, institutionalization, and lack of employment happen when secondary characteristics are left unhelped. So I'm going to stop with just those first five, but that can bring some clarity for our listeners. And again, you can go to FASD.org. So that's families affected by fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Not only can you find all 50 facts, but they have a lot of other really good stuff on there also. So
yes.
Laura, you mentioned you took your kids to Rochester to get help. So tell us where you went in Rochester.
Yes.
So our listeners can know about that.
Yes. So we went to, it was formerly known as Kirsch, but now it is the University of Rochester Medical Center. It is the behavioral and the pediatric behavioral clinic that is there. You might even see, if you put it in, Galisano Children's Hospital is around there as well. They treat all different types of eating disorder concerns, and there's, I mean, you name it, it's there. And when we went there, we worked with Dr. Christy Petrenko, who was amazing. She's just on fire for fetal alcohol. And Lynn Cole, who also works there, who is also just wonderful. And they were just, the whole team, like I said, everybody there has been above and beyond. They have a place where you can, you know, when you go in, there's books that you can take out. And then they have, you know, connections to people or different websites or classes that they hold and whatnot. So it really, if you're near Rochester and are looking or have some concerns or are unsure, I highly recommend going, because, you know, looking back, FASD affects 10 of the brain domains. And so looking at that, you know, that's a huge, huge part. Obviously, it affects your executive function, your regulation, ability to control emotions, your memory, like you said, the language, and it's receptive or expressive. Attention.
Impulse control yep. is a huge one with especially my youngest.
Absolutely. Impulse control, yes. Adaptive behavioral social skills or social communication, motor skills, and neuroanatomy, your brain structure and functioning, and academic achievement. And I think the big misconception is, well, if they have this, then they can't do this, this, and this. And it's so opposite that. There are such amazing strengths in these kids. And I remember listening to Jeff Noble one time, and he said once, I think it was him or a guest on there, if you've met someone with FASD, you've met someone with FASD, because they all look different. So you might, I mean, I have, like I said, 5 kids here, and there's no exact on any of it. We have 2 not diagnosed at this point, but obviously working towards that, knowing now what we know, because Aiden was only diagnosed in 2019 in the fall. I wish we would have gotten it sooner, but once again, you don't know. And then we brought Lucas in February, and he had the full diagnosis of FAS. He had some of the features in auditory processing, which was along with it, general anxiety. So the anxiety piece goes along with it. And that's kind of where we get stuck sometimes is, you know, if you go somewhere or even with their IEP meetings and stuff, they see anxiety, and people can do that. They'll look at it and go, oh, yeah, anxiety. Okay, we have social groups. We have this, that. Not realizing, because of the brain damage, there is anxiety then. That it's not the type of anxiety that you would normally think. And with him, it's social phobia. So with Lucas, we really noticed in 7th grade, he started a really, his skin on his head, it almost looked like cradle cap. His hands and feet were peeling, and I thought, something's going on. But because he doesn't talk, he's very quiet, it's hard to get a lot out of him. Brought him, you know, to the doctors, and it was stress-induced psoriasis. He internalizes, and even when it talks about emotions, you know, I was talking to you about this, that, Sandra, that I cry, and I can say I'm sad. I'm sad, you know, because of I got hurt or whatever. we've really learned how to label emotions, because if they're sad, and I say they're, let's say, for example, my son Lucas, I don't remember a tear. From when he was little, I remember him crying if he was overstimulated or sensory. But I can't tell you the last time he cried, but he's been so sad. And I'll say, how are you doing? How are you feeling? I don't know. Well, no, you do know. No, I don't know. Okay. How does your body feel? So we're really working on putting an emotion to what's going on with their body. You know, well, I'm nervous. I'm afraid. Why are you afraid? Let's talk about that. You know, what does it look like when you're scared, you know, or, and let's put a label on it. So we really, things that would come natural that I just assumed, well, you're sad, you're crying, you can say you're sad. It's not always the case. However, knowing that with him, and having IEP meetings then to follow, that's been, I would say, a huge challenge at this point, because we're lucky that they don't have the behaviors at school, but then they come home, and we were talking about that, where it's, oh, here we go, unfolding. And so prior to the pandemic and everything, I mean, Lucas would come home and go to the basement and sit doing Legos for 2 hours and just kind of rock and hum. Just, you know, he had to just really pull himself back together.
I call it decompressed, because my youngest, who our school district is back, and because he has an IEP, he can go all 5 days, but it's a shortened school day. But when I pick him up, he is so wound tight and stressed. Mm-hmm. I can't even go to the store. I have to come straight home, and he goes to his room to decompress, which looks like rocking music. So that is, you know, that's a huge part of it. And to talk about getting a diagnosis, my kids, you were able to go out there to the hospital in Rochester, which I suppose mm-hmm. where I am in upstate New York, I could get there as well. Or any of our listeners who may be in New York, but my kids saw, and I feel like, to me, it was easy to get a diagnosis, but I'm finding out that is actually quite rare. When I took our youngest to, we were seeing a counselor, and she agreed, because I brought up FAS with her, and she goes, yes, I do agree with, that's probably a lot of what you're dealing with. And she recommended that we take him to a developmental pediatrician. She gave me the name, and in our area near Albany, it was Dr. Anthony Malone at Capital Care Developmental Pediatrics in Latham. And it was quite easy to get that diagnosis, right? But if our listeners, if you suspect FASD, you really need to advocate for your child, do the research, find a developmental pediatrician or a geneticist to diagnose, but don't take no for an answer, and don't just take, oh no, it's probably not that because they don't have the facial features, because that's sort of old school mentality. There's been so much research done, you know, and you really need to know and understand this. It's an invisible disability, but we're living with it every day. And if you're living with any of these behaviors that Laura and I have been talking about, you really, really need to get that help. So getting a diagnosis is one thing. It's very, very helpful to finally have that. But caring for a child or children with FASD is quite another. So Laura, and I know I don't want to run out of time. I want to make sure we hit all our points. But how are you and Steve navigating FASD? What are the resources that you utilize? What are you learning? How are you keeping yourself educated in this?
Well, it's like this whole new world. And I have really just, like you said, if you're trying to find out information and, you know, you can't be helped, I've learned, okay, I'm not going to take it personal, but I'm going to keep moving on because I got to find someone who will help us. And that's okay. But I think you get to that point. So for me, you had mentioned the trust, the TBRI, the trust-based relational intervention, Karen Purvis. You can download any of her YouTube videos. So we have that training, and that was amazing because it deals with trauma-based training, And so that was helpful, beyond helpful. I've really done a lot of research in regards to the books. And so the books that Rochester actually recommended was a book called Trying Differently Rather Than Harder.
Yeah.
Which I know, I'm sure you've heard, it's Diane Maubin. And there's another one that I really enjoy. It's Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorders. It's Parenting a Child with an Invisible Disability. It's got an octopus on the front. And that's by Julia Brown and Dr. Mary Mather, M-A-T-H-E-R. That's great too. You know, they're those books that you read and then you go back and go, okay, I'm going to highlight this part. A book that a friend of mine recommended, and it is called Different. It's by Sally Clarkson, and it's a story of an outside the box kid and a mom who loved him. And that's a wonderful, wonderful book as well. And one that I just received not too long ago, it is called Late, Lost, and Unprepared. And it's a parent's guide to helping children with executive function. And it's by Joyce Cooper Kahn and Lori Dietzel. And I can send that information to you if you need it, Sandra. That one is great because it really talks about, well, we talk about executive function because a lot of that really comes into play as the kids, you know, as they're getting older, especially, and, you know, they have this, but now how can we help them?
Yeah.
And how can we help ourselves? And that was something also I wanted to bring up real quick, Sandra, was that you had a guest on. I listened to it just the other day. She was amazing. She talked about facets. She was a facet trainer. Oh, I don't have her name in front of me. It was your most recent one.
Let's see. My most recent one, Kelly Hughes.
Yes, I believe.
I'm not sure if we talked about FAS with Kelly, though. We'll look
and now,
her.
And now I brought her up because I'm like, I was listening and I was like, yes, yes. She was talking about services and how they're all about giving services to kids when they're younger and in elementary school. And as they get to middle school and high school, they slowly start removing the services. In fact, it might have been on FASD Hope, which was the North Carolina FASD informed.
Yes.
And she was saying how it needs to flip-flop. And in fact, these kids need almost more services as they get older.
Yeah.
And I think that's the struggle where we've been right now is because over all of this, trying to figure out who are my people? How do I find out supports? And you were saying like, you know, what did you do or what are you doing right now? I have a lot of friends who have adopted children who have FASD, but they're younger. My kids are now teens and I'm going, okay, what do I do? What do I do? Who do we talk to? So I turn to podcasts and I obviously listen to your podcast, the Honestly Adoption podcast with the Berries.
Yes,
that was amazing. And when they started talking one time and they're like, we have two in high school. And I was like, what? I felt like, yay, you know, they're older, so I can kind of connect there. Same with FASD Hope. And, you know, It's a Brain Thing was another podcast that I listened to as well. And there's some Facebook groups. And there was one I heard through a podcast and went on Facebook. It's Blue Collar Homeschool Group.
Yes.
And she started talking and she was talking about how her adopted kids, she was trying to figure it out. What does it look like for them? They ended up creating, I believe it's called Little Buckaroos, and it's in the West by Colorado. And it is a little restaurant, pizza, ice cream shop, and her kids work at it. Yes. And so for the first time, I felt hopeful because you're getting all this heavy stuff. Now, what do you do with it? And now, oh, by the way, here's COVID-19. So we're going to take everything that's hard and really flip it on its head. Yeah. So for kids, some of my kids, most of them need structure and consistency, and they need to have their schedules. And so then you go from going into school and having everything to now flip it. And that was back in March.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, this is going to be interesting. It was a hot mess in our house. I mean, it was a mess. And I was teaching preschool. So I was trying to finish up that from home. But then I had, you know, my five that were kind of all over the place and getting emails. They had Zoom calls, and the school was very new to what was going on too. And I remember looking at my emails one day from the school, and I go, okay, I have 210. I don't even know where to begin. And so at that point, I closed the computer and I said, you know what? If you have stuff missing, you're going to have stuff missing, because I'm going to be mom. I'm going to be mom here, and I'm going to be a good mom here. During this time, I can't wear all the hats right now.
Right.
And I wasn't doing any of it really good. I was doing it, but I wasn't doing it good. Yeah. And so that was like a relief at that time. Then the summer happened, and our two oldest got jobs, and they've been doing well. I definitely can see where a 3-hour shift sometimes for my oldest, it's exhausting. It's exhausting. It's a lot of multitasking. We've had to work on just, you know, remembering to call in, you know, to see if you have to work, things like that, it's definitely a lot. My friend described it as being their outward brain.
Yes.
And that's hard because they're also at an age where they want to do it themselves. Mm-hmm. And yet you don't want to be that, you know, smothering parent, but you also know what they're up against. And it wasn't until one day over the summer where my oldest said, I'm not frustrated. That's not the word. But I just hate the way my brain doesn't work for me sometimes.
Mm.
And that was hard because I thought, yeah, that stinks. And I'm sorry. I'm sorry that happened. So really trying to navigate through that right now. She ended up getting a 504, which, you know, she's a senior, trying to figure out what that looks like. You know, both my girls, their friends are driving and they're talking about college and you have to fit in this box, right? And I'm trying to tell them it's okay if you're not ready. It's okay to look at it different. It's okay. And it's hard because you get other people that are like, so what are your plans with your life? What are your plans? And I'm like, we're just trying to get through today right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, I definitely think there's good days and bad days like anything. I wish they could all fall on the same day. I mean, that would be kind of nice around here. You know, it's like, oh, pick one. I've probably done more growth myself than anything because I've had to adjust my expectations. And I look back full circle now, and here I was wanting to get married and have two kids and it was going to be beautiful. And now I have, you know, we have five children adopted, special needs, looks nothing like I thought. And yet I wouldn't trade it for anything, as hard as it is. I think that's the bigger piece, is just reaching out, finding your people, finding that you're not alone. Cause the podcast alone, I'll listen to them while I'm cleaning. I also know not to set myself up for disappointment. You know, if I'm going to talk to people and really want someone to understand some of the stuff we're dealing with, but if my audience is going to be an audience, and I say audience, but like, you know, I have really good friends, and I'm lucky to, you know, my husband and me have great support team. However, I do know that there's some things that I would talk to some people about and some I wouldn't, because, and it's not because I don't believe that they're not good people. It's just, you have to know who would understand it, you know?
Yeah.
So that's been
the people that are really walking on the journey with us really understand it the best. So I do want to make sure that we let our listeners know that we're going to put in the links in the show notes and blog post for this episode, the resources that we mentioned. I know several times we mentioned FASD Success, which is a podcast hosted by Jeff Noble. It's amazing. Laura and I both are, we listen to it constantly. FASD Hope is another, it's a newer podcast, but not Natalie Vecchione, who is the host. She previously hosted another podcast.
She's great.
Yeah, for an FASD organization in North Carolina, but now she's doing FASD Hope. That's another podcast. Positive Adoption by my friend Kathleen Guire, who's also an adoptive mom. Her children are all older and out of the house now, but she also adopted internationally, and some of her kiddos had FASD. And then we mentioned Dr. Karen Purvis and the folks at the TBRI. But through Empowered to Connect, there is another podcast called the Empowered Parent Podcast, hosted by Ryan and Kayla North, who formerly were the directors of Empowered to Connect. But now they lead One Big Happy Home, and they have phenomenal training, whether you're talking trauma or, you know, including FASD. And I know, Laura, you mentioned Honestly Adoption by Mike and Kristen.
Yeah.
Excellent. There's books out there. There's websites. There are a lot of resources. And the main thing is, and especially when you listen to the podcast where people who are walking in this journey, like Laura and I are, and share their stories, then we feel less alone.
Yeah.
And we always learn something. And there's always something to learn because it's different when our kids are little. It's different when our kids are teenagers. It's different when there's a pandemic and everything is upside down. It's different when they are about to, you know, enter young adulthood. It's different every age and stage. So it's nonstop educating and learning. And I know, you know, you're on that same journey, and we're getting to the end here. So I'm going to jump to, and you kind of already have been giving us some of this advice that I love, but as we wrap up, Laura, any final thoughts, what is on your heart that you want to be sure that our listeners hear today?
I think, you know, a few things. I think, whoever's listening, and whether you know, have this already going on, or you feel like, you know, there might be signs, you are not alone. There are so many people out there that are walking the path similar. It's all going to look different, but similar, and there's supports. And I tend to, if anything, be your child's advocate. Don't be afraid to think about how people are going to view you. They're not living it. You are. And if you're not going to fight for your child, who will? Because it's a very challenging, FASD is just challenging itself, because there are, like I said, medical doctors that, if they're not willing to listen, well, how do you get the schools to listen? So educate people, educate healthcare if they need, you know, information, educate families, people around. They don't know it if you don't share it. And so even before, like, our kids' appointments, we had one yesterday for our youngest, and I was nervous. I thought, oh boy, I called ahead. Because he's 13, he doesn't want me talking about him while he's there or shutting the door. So I called ahead and said, I don't know if you have this on file. This is the diagnosis. This is what happens. When we got there, they were wonderful. Mm-hmm. And they didn't make a big deal out of it, but they handled it well, knew his anxiety level. The doctor spoke with me separately, but it wasn't where Aiden felt, you know, like we were talking about him. So things like that, bring their diagnosis with you, that if you need to share it, when I go to the IEP meetings, bring the information, hand it out to the people at the table. This is my child. He or she is more than what's on this paper. And I want you to understand what will help them. And if someone can't help you, then that's not the right person. And you need to find, you know, your team. And I think I hang things up on on my walls to remind myself of things. And something that I have on my wall, and it just is a good reminder all the time to me that if God puts Goliath in front of you, he must believe there's a David inside of you. Mm. And on my down days, on my hard days, on my days where I think I can't do this, I'm exhausted, I'm tired, I don't want to have to think about how I'm going to, you know, give a question to someone or how I have to worry about everyone's, you know, things that irritate them. What about my things that irritate me? You know, I don't want to have to do it. I have to take a deep breath. I feel like nature is huge for me. I like to just breathe in the air. And I look at those signs and I hang some up that really just remind me that, you know what, even on our worst days, even in our hardest days, God knew what he was doing when he put these kids in our home. I do think about the future and I do get worried about it. Absolutely. It scares me, but I can't go there. I take one day at a time. So I encourage everyone to take one day at a time and just find your people and, you know, just love your kids where they're at.
So. I love that. Thank you so much, Laura. Words of wisdom. I know that you and I could talk for hours longer, and we probably will, but we'll let our listeners go for now. Again, we really talked about a lot of amazing resources, podcasts, books, websites. So I'll make sure that links to all of those things are in the show notes for this episode and in the podcast or the relating blog post for that this week. So our listeners can find it there. But Laura, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Oh, thank you.
And for encouraging us today. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. I loved it.
And thank you for being with us today for episode 243 of Orphans No More. Again, as promised, we're going to post all those links about FASD on our show notes and our website for the corresponding blog post for this episode. So you can find all of that at justicefororphansny.org. We are so excited to have you on this journey with us. And it's quite the journey, as you heard Laura share, especially if you're a foster and adoptive parent, dealing with trauma, dealing with FASD, the racial issues, the pandemic, homeschooling, remote schooling, hybrid schooling, whatever it all is, it's quite an adventure. I'm just so glad that you're in this with us on the adventure together, on the journey together. So we're excited to have you along. Pray about how you would be involved in caring for kids in crisis. What is it that the Lord would have you to do? And if you were inspired by today's show, please subscribe if you haven't already and leave a review and share it with your friends on your social media. We really appreciate that. And of course, we love to hear from you. Contact us. You can leave us a message at justicefororphansny.org. Also on our social media at Justice for Orphans, or you can email me directly if you have any questions, if you're looking for some answers, if you just want to reach out for whatever reason, you can email me directly, Sandra Flack, JFO@gmail.com, and stay in touch through our social media. Stay tuned to this podcast and the social media for news about the release of my book. I know I keep talking about it, but it is coming. COVID did slow things down with my kids home for 7 months. It's been a little bit challenging to finish off things and have the quiet to do that, but I know you can relate. So keep me in your prayers as we get finished. It's coming. It's coming. Prayers appreciated. Thanks again for listening, and I look forward to being with you next time on Orphans No More.
Thank you for listening to Orphans No More, for sharing what you've heard and praying for vulnerable children everywhere. We hope you are inspired to walk out James 1:27 in whatever way God calls you. For more information, visit justicefororphansny.org.